welcome.
Hello,
welcome,
Vinny.
Ladies and gentlemen, to another exciting episode of the Vinny Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, New Zealand, the island change procrastination in the sunny slave South Pacific. It's not only fluoridated, it's also Fukushima irradiated, which, according to the Prime Minister, is good for the economy, because now everybody can get a part-time job as an incandescent light bulb. And my very special guest is an expert on the mythical creature. Well, I wouldn't say it's mythical, actually. It's very real. Shall we say the generally misunderstood and perceived to be mythical creature, the Sasquatch. And his name is Jeremy Lyons. And he does not bear resemblance to one of these creatures, I must say. Jeremy, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Vinny. You say I do bear a resemblance or not?
No. I say you don't.
Oh, I don't. Well, I get it a lot that I do, so I'm confused.
Well, see, I'd expect you to be at least 3 foot taller and much bulkier and hairier than you currently are. Which, I don't. Let's move
That's
on.
That's true.
Yeah. Jeremy, why don't you just explain to us a little bit about who you are and what it is you do? And I believe, what was your website again? Was it realsasquatch.com, I think?
No, I don't have a website on Sasquatch. The person I've worked with mostly on this is a guy named Kiwani Lapsaritis, and he has a site called the Sasquatch People, .com. And he's got a book out. He's got two books out. So I kind of work in association with him, and I really can't call myself an expert, but, you know, it's almost hard to call anybody an expert on Sasquatch. It's such a great unknown. And there's very little, if anything, we can really take to the bank about them. I think the Roger Patterson film, you know, it we can take to the bank. But so much of the other stuff, it's always on the other side of the veil. But I've been
in. Let's start simple and just explain how you got into the subject matter.
Right. Very, very young, actually. You know, even my earliest memories, they contacted me psychically and through dreams and such. And I didn't know what it was until I knew there was something going on. And I remember as a child getting excited about watching Tarzan movies and seeing him interact with gorillas, thinking, oh, this is reminiscent of what I'm trying to understand. But then when I was I'm about 58 right now, so the Patterson film came out when I was in about the sixth grade about. When I saw the pictures of the Patterson film, I just knew instantly that this is what was interesting me in this idea of there being a large hairy animal out there that I only had a sort of a psychic glimpse through my dreams. And I would think about them all the time, but not until 87 I decided to go out to Oregon. I live in Atlanta, Georgia. Decided to go out to Oregon and try to get some real empirical information about them. Just happened to, right a week before I was leaving, saw a tabloid while checking out at the grocery store with a headline of, like, I was Sasquatch's love slave, and I just happened to buy it for the heck of it. And by happenstance, there's a little side box in there with a mention about Kiwani Lapsaritis and had his phone number, so I called him before leaving. And he said, well, you're welcome to come out to my place when you're out here, and I might be able to help you. And he's been researching them ever since he was a youngin'. And he's a very well psychically endowed person. He can dowse quite well. You know, there's like, you know, map dowse as well. You're probably familiar with Uri Geller, who was a great psychic back in the 70s. And he actually made almost the bulk of his money by map dowsing for oil companies to tell them where to drill. And so it's a standard practice that a lot of people seem to be talented with. And Kiwani was definitely one of them. He sent me into an area. He map dowsed for me and showed me the map and said, here's where they are. And this was in a Kamiopsi wilderness, southern Oregon. Said, here's where they are. Here's where you ought to camp out. Just stay there a couple of weeks and read a book, whatever. And so I did, and sure enough, they came around, and could smell them, could hear them at night knocking down trees, I would go into their area a little closer, and they start rapping on trees, but I never saw them. And of course, like I said, and there's nothing there I could take back to the bank, and there's nothing empirical to take back from it. But you just have to, say to yourself that yeah, that's what it was, because it couldn't be much else. So I went back to Kiwani's house about 100 miles away, and when I walked in the door, he instantly was aware of the fact that the Sasquatch, one of the Sasquatches that was there, astrally followed me back, and to get a bearing on what was going on. Although Kiwani Lapsaratus had several contacts with Sasquatch before that, but anyway, I'm getting ahead of myself. So anyway, 3 days later, it seemed to show up in the physical. The landlord there actually saw it, and then this landlord had no interest in Sasquatch, but he was quite taken back by the fact that there was one hanging out at his house. This was out in the country in middle Oregon. And then I had an encounter with it as I walked outside at night. It jumped off a tree right in front of me, hit the ground like a car hitting the ground, and then I could hear footfalls as it loped about, five or six paces away and stopped. And I couldn't see it because it was pitch black. But so I think that testifies, one, to the fact that they really are there, and that Kiwani had this ability to, and that map dowsing really works. Another event that occurred was while I was there visiting him and staying there, two women showed up, one of whose husband was missing, and they asked him to map douse, because he already had a reputation. He worked for police departments and things like that. So they found him and came to him and asked him to map douse where their husband might be. This husband might be one. And sure enough, he mapped douse and said, here's what I think. He went off the road at this particular place, and he may still be alive. I'm not sure, or he's close to death. And this was a week after he first disappeared. Sure enough, it was in the paper the next day that they found him in the car and where he mapped out. And so, it's kind of a catch-can thing. Sometimes, dowsers can do it. Sometimes they can't. But this was back in 87, and I got a firsthand ability. Now, I spent a summer with Kiwani traveling around and visiting many of the people that he had written about in his book, where he catalogs a variety of just regular people who have places out in the country and have ongoing relationships with Sasquatch, maybe not ongoing, but at least one encounter, some of them having ongoing relationships. They may live near what is called a vortex, because we can talk about this, but there's two camps of Sasquatch. One is a nuts and bolts, flesh and blood, maybe an ape-human hybrid, but basically just a primate who has remained elusive. And the other camp is that this is an interdimensional issue. They can still be flesh and blood. There's still a nuts and bolts aspect to it. But in addition to being flesh and blood, they have this added ability to go interdimensional, perhaps much like a shamanic tradition would tell about shamans being able to go interdimensional, whatever that's worth.
Before all the shamans got wiped out by the Spanish, of course.
Or at least went into another dimension. But, so since 87, Kiwani and I have kept in close touch. I've gone out there and visited him some, and him here. And he has kind of been the head of a network of a growing number of people. As I was mentioning, I got to travel with him and revisit these people that he chronicles in his first book. And, they're just regular down-to-earth people. They're certainly not out there claiming this experience for any benefit. There's no benefit that they've ever gotten or really attempted to get. There's many of them.
Can I mention something here? Because what people often do is they'll start ridiculing you and saying, oh, there's no evidence, it's crazy, it's stupid, as if, yeah, somebody would devote their entire life and fields of research to something that has no evidence and doesn't exist. Right.
You get that from people who really haven't looked into it as much as you do have to look into it in order to come to a conclusion that there's just got to be something here. It doesn't make sense for there not to be.
Isn't there a large percentage of the American and indeed global wilderness that still has not even been set foot on by man? And if a creature was to hide or at the very least remain undetected, they'd have an enormous amount of space for which to live without ever coming into contact with human beings at all, particularly if they're afraid of them and try to stay away from them.
That's true, but there's something about the phenomenon that kind of goes beyond that, in the sense that just about every state in the United States has a Sasquatch, and sometimes they will appear and hang out in an area, or I see several sightings in an area that it would be a pretty heavily populated area. And here again, the answer to that may be interdimensionalism, because they can come in and out of you know, it's like interdimensionalism is like the New York subway. You could be following somebody, and all of a sudden they disappear and then pop up, you know, down in 51st Street. And if you don't know about the subway system, you have no idea how that happened. But all they had to do was go down a flight of stairs and take the train to another place. Yeah, that's just a brief, it's just a rough analogy. What interdimensionalism really is beyond me. But there do seem to be these vortexes that they use. That seems to be common knowledge, and they have to be at a certain place to get there. Maybe these vortexes go in and out. I don't know. But I don't know.
Well, like a wormhole sort of Stargate type thing.
Right, right. Either when I was out there,
using their mind rather than some kind of physical device.
Right, using it's natural. Right, it's maybe a tech. You know, our way of doing things is technology, and maybe with some technology we could create wormholes and such. But evidently, these are natural wormholes of some sort. And maybe some speculate that, you know, ley lines may play into this. Earth meridians, Earth grid meridians, and such.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about, say, I wonder if there've ever been humans who've been able to do this kind of thing, like do the astral travel, appear in different places, and so on and so forth. Maybe they'd been a monk for 60 years up in the mountain meditating after a long line of something. You know, maybe Sasquatch has descended from a long, long line of psychically gifted beings, and they've simply been honing their craft over the last thousands of odd years, and now can, come and go as they please, as it were.
Yeah, yeah. And just like we devoted ourselves to a technologically view of overcoming hardship of living in the world, you know, and making things easier on ourselves by technological means, they have developed psychic means to advance their state of wellness. And I think that, well, the shamans would be an example of humans who have gone that route. And David Alexander Neal, a anthropologist back in the 20s, I think, she wrote a book about her explorations in Tibet and these monks who tupas that would be able to astral travel and be in two places at once, who could, like Emanuel Swedenborg supposedly was able to appear in two places at once, and him having kind of a shamanic personality. So yeah, you know, these are mysteries that have not come to the forefront of our culture, but are there. The examples are there.
Well, the word hermetic springs to mind, and if there was some kind of a shamanic species or whatever, as I think you're asserting that Sasquatch might be,
right,
they certainly wouldn't want to hang out in the cities for too long. They'd want to be out in the wilderness and maybe just look in from time to time, wouldn't they?
Right, evidently, yeah. Yeah. You know, I could, like, this is pretty guessy on my part, but I sometimes wonder to give a view of how I think they might think, I would like to refer back to a psychological study of how we deal with arithmetic in our culture, or the whole Western culture and Oriental as well. We think arithmetically, kind of. There's this book out called Number Sense where this psychologist studied babies to see how babies perceive mathematically, and also Aboriginal tribes who do not have a culture of numbers, who only have words for one and two and many. So they have no, you know, these are like Amazonian Yakima Indians and such that they just don't deal with arithmetic. And they give them some tests to see how they think. And the test that they gave them, one example of it, is that there's a line, and on one side of the...
Well, Jeremy, we're coming to break. So just keep that thought there about the tests and arithmetic on the Amazon, and we'll be coming back in a minute. To come up with a joke, you know what you call a Sasquatch who works for the mafia? A console Yeti. We'll be right back after the break at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com.
The flight to New Zealand by plane from New York City takes 22 hours. So from the Twin Cities, 19. I mean, I fly all the time, and 6 hours on a plane is like a lot, and 19 is wrong. And they distract you. They feed you, and then they feed you some more, and then they feed you, give me a dessert. I'll do a dessert, you prick. Give me that dessert. I'll have a Bloody Mary. Yeah, give me a whiskey sour. Yeah, give me whatever you got. Just more liquor, more liquor, more liquor. And then when you're done, there's still 16 hours to go.
Welcome back.
You want to know what it's like?
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. My very special guest is a Sasquatch researcher named Jeremy Lines. Welcome back, mate. And you were talking about arithmetic and the Amazons. If you could continue your story and how they were testing their arithmetic there, that'd be awesome.
Well, you know, Vinnie, if I could just postpone that a second and back up a little. And say that, you know, we use the word Sasquatch, but actually I should have clarified earlier that it's kind of like shifted away from Sasquatch. We're actually talking about a more humanoid. There are Sasquatch out there, but in addition to the Sasquatch, there's another group of large, hairy, forest people, and they refer to themselves as the Ancient Ones. And so they live in their tribes, such as they may live. We really don't know, because maybe interdimensional for the most part. All this is very foggy with me, but they are much more humanoid. They don't have the sagittal crest like the Sasquatch do. So, like the character that was in the Patterson film was a Sasquatch, and a lot of people see Sasquatch a lot of the times. But increasingly, there are more and more reports of people seeing what are referred to as the Ancient Ones. And these are very humanoid-like, but they both communicate telepathically. Sasquatch can telepathically communicate as well as the Ancient Ones. And in addition to this, there's even more other humanoid hybrids out there. There's the dog people, as some researchers are covering them. There's the Inuit tribes of British Columbia have long had this character in their folklore about called the Otter Man, which they say it looks just like a man, looks a lot like a Sasquatch or a large humanoid, but is not the Sasquatch. There is a difference. They have their own peculiar traits that make them what they are. And so I wanted to say that I'm speaking more about Ancient Ones.
Do you think there's actually a number of different humanoid species that we don't know about that are cruising around the forest somewhere, either astrally or physically?
Yeah, down in your neighborhood in the Solomon Islands, there are different levels. There's the smaller fairy types, of course, the ones that they found bones of not a few years back.
I remember that story. Yeah.
Right, and hobbit types, and then there's you know the Yowie in Australia, and they're in the Solomon Islands. There's a Sasquatch type, but. And then there's the large orange hairy man of China, and all these seem to have a morphology that's a little there's variations among them and perhaps variations in temperament and personality.
In Siberia, there has been many stories coming out of people breeding with these Sasquatches, and I've seen pictures, old pictures, I think they're like from early 1900s, of these extremely large and extremely ugly people.
Yes, right.
Yeah,
there was a Russian pet guy who captured a female, and she had two children by either him or other men of the village that mated with her. She was kept outside for the most part, or in the basement, and they had pictures of these two surviving children that went on to be citizens of the Russian community. Yeah, strange. But it's pretty well documented. Lord Pye, in his book, Everything You Know Is Wrong, that's the title of it, documents that fairly well in that book.
Now, on top of this, we were talking about different species. So what, there's Sasquatch, Yeti, the Ancient Ones, fairies, hobbits type thing. It's basically like we actually never left the fantasy sci-fi novel world, did we? It just went out of the limelight.
Yeah. It's stranger than we can even imagine. Yeah.
Well, I think more to the point, you couldn't imagine it if it didn't already exist.
Yeah, right.
Some form.
Yeah. So, also referring back to these ancient ones, I just happened to run across something a couple of days ago in a book. This book is called Wolf Scratch Wilderness, and it's a memoir of a families that lived in this mountain area in North Georgia. So this was a book chronicling the families that lived there. But it went back to the Cherokees and the Crees. So she started the book with that. She started the book in the date of 1620. So the book starts out with a grandmother, an Indian grandmother, a Creek, telling her children about the ancient ones. And they use that very term. I talked to the author, and she's trying to find me a direct reference, but that's how it was quoted in the story that she got out of the famous book American Indian Myths and Legends by Richard Eagles. And so let me just read a couple of first lines from quoting this story that came out of the Indian tradition. And in the year of 1620, little mother, tell us again of the ancient ones. Tell us what the wise old men told a council when you were young. Little Star, the grandmother, smiled, and the southeastern slopes of a nearby ridge was the site of many stone cairns left by people of long ago. No one remembered who they were, how they arrived, or why they left, but all agreed they had been very wise. Men had long pondered their signs left as petroglyphs, earth mounds, stone effigies, and altars. Little Star stared into the fire again, and she began to speak. The ancient ones were here when the earth was closer to the sky, she said. They knew many secrets because in those days the Dream Father appeared to them often and taught them even as they slept. They learned many truths in this manner, including secrets of the afterlife called the journey to the land beyond the sunrise. Ultimately, the Dream Father told the ancient ones to build many stone mounds and clusters on certain hillsides. In dreams, they were shown how to place every stone in circles within circles. And small stones form the inner circles with larger stones on the outside. Many stone mounds were arranged in patterns pleasing to those who looked down from the land beyond the sunrise. So
this would be kind of like sort of a Stonehenge, things on ley lines, so on and so forth, right?
Right, and this country was riddled with them. These megalithic structures, and the Indians supposedly said that, you know, we didn't build them; they were here when we got here. And
there's the same thing going on here in New Zealand. There's a whole bunch of artifacts and megalithic structures that have been discovered, and the Maori have said, I don't know who built them.
Yeah, it's a mystery, and how the mathematics behind them is quite intriguing as well. I know you have Randall Carlson.
This is actually a good segue to go back to. You were talking about arithmetic and teaching the Amazonians or something, testing them.
Yeah, okay. So in this book called Number Sense, the psychologist does a comparative study between our normal sense of how we view mathematics, the average person, and how mathematics are processed in the brain by people who don't have a number in their culture. such as the Yakima, I'm not sure if that's, I'm pronouncing that right, but the Amazonian tribe, and babies as well. And it, and so they gave them this test. A piece of paper would be drawn a line, and on one end of the line would be one, and on the other line of the, on the other end of the line would be 10 objects, you know, like 10 apples or whatever. And they were asked they were shown a picture of 5 apples and asked them, where would you place these 5 apples on this line between 1 and 10? And we would place it in the middle because we think arithmetically, and we think, well, 1, the average between 0 and 10 or 1 and 10, the average would be 5. So we would consider 5 to be right in the middle between the two. But over and over again, they structured the test in such a way that I guess, you know, they were scientifically assured that they were doing it correctly to conclude that they would put the 5 closer to the 10, and they would, because they concluded that these people were thinking logarithmically, much like few people know what a slide rule looks like these days, but if you look at a logarithmic scale, going from 1 to 10, between 1 and 2 takes up 30% of the line rather than 10%. So that takes a big chunk. And because instead of putting the 5 between the 1 and the 10, you would put the square root of 10, which is 3.16. You would put that in the middle because it's multiplied, because logarithm means to multiply. Whereas we add things, the natives and even the babies, they think logarithmically where you multiply. So to them, the natural midpoint between 0 and 10, or 1 and 10, the natural midpoint would be the square root of 10, where to us it would be the average of 1 and 10. So you see what I'm saying? They think in a logarithmic pattern, and they've studied babies who are adopting our, you know, arithmetic way of thinking in school, and they want to be logarithmically in their thinking. But they eventually they give up and they switch over to the arithmetic way of looking at things, the additive way. Instead of multiplying, they add kind of in their way of thinking of numbers and how they operate. But the world is logarithmically. To view the world logarithmically would be a more perfect way of looking at the world, because that's how gravity expresses itself, light expresses itself. Everything, you know, is logarithmic. But we represent it in a additive sense, in a arithmetic sense, instead of a logarithmic sense or multiplicative sense. So we're kind of hindered. Now, we're hindered in a way in such that evidently this is a great way to think if you want to build a technology or, master the world in the way that we have mastered it, evidently, like to think in Pythagorean theorems and such as that. We need to think this way. If we thought logarithmically, like a tribe in the Amazon, we would probably be handicapped in some way, or much like the Sasquatch, we wouldn't develop any technological achievement of our material surroundings. We wouldn't be able to turn things into items like we do, you know, through our technology. Maybe we would be forced to focus on a psychic aspect of ourselves rather than a technological aspect of the material objects around us. But perhaps we could learn from the ancient ones, if this is the way they think. We could learn some things that would be helpful to us, and they could learn things that are helpful to them. I don't know, but I think that might be
the entire world is the entire world is just built upon mathematics upon mathematics upon mathematics, isn't it? And so I think that if there's an agenda to dumb people down and take them out of touch with the natural world, which is incidentally built on mathematics, you'd try to eradicate a correct form of mathematics and try to replace it with an inferior kind.
I'd say maybe it's just what we got to go through in order to get where we got to get. We have to, you know, if we're going to go this route of taking raw materials and turning them into something else that will take us to the stars, then it's the burden we have to go through and all the problems that go along with it. But that's just the way it goes, you know. And evidently there are people out there who don't go this route, and but they never know the joys of watching TV for what that's worth. Go ahead.
Well, you were talking about mathematics and how they relate to megalithic structures like large stones around the circle and small stones inside the circle and things of this nature. What is the point in that? I mean, are they trying to channel some kind of earth energies, or is it like pyramids, like the Chinese say that they balance the earth's chi?
Well, yeah, kind of like, yeah, probably both. You know, like Randall Carlson, the guy you had on your show a couple of weeks ago, who studies this in depth, says that, you know, there's this great effort to create on Earth a mirror of the astronomical patterns, and as it says here in the this passage I just read, this account by the Creek Indians. That they learn many truths in this manner, including secrets. I'm in the wrong place. In dreams, they were shown how to place every stone in circles within circles, small stones within larger stone circles, but the mounds were arranged in patterns
similar to the. That seems similar to the structure of the Milky Way and the solar system: circles within circles within circles.
Well, at least that they would, that they may not be a direct reference, although in some cases they would, like there's this pattern of Virgo, the constellation Virgo, being placed in the placement of cathedrals across France. So that's sort of a one-on-one correspondence, but certainly that the mathematics they use would act like a interface between the movement of the Earth and the Sun and the stars. And so here's this statement coming from this Indian story saying that many stone mounds were arranged in patterns pleasing to those who looked down from the land beyond the sunrise. So there seemed to be this effort to please the gods by emulating these celestial patterns.
Mm. All right. Well, there's a good place to leave it for the moment. We'll be coming back in just a few minutes, ladies and gentlemen. After the break at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com, Jeremy Lyons talking about Sasquatch is my guest. Back in a minute. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's the lighter side of genocide, because in a world so full of chaos and madness, if you lose your sense of humour, you'll go friggin' nuts. My very special guest is Jeremy Lyons. Jeremy, welcome back. What were we talking about just before break there? We're talking about mathematics and megalithic structures and what they actually mean and what they're trying to accomplish with these arrangements.
Right, and as a side note, you know, throughout the 1800s here in America, they were plowing up earth mounds and finding skeletons of giants, you know, 7 to 8 feet, sometimes 10 feet tall skeletons with large double rows of teeth in the jaw, and nobody knows what that's about. But skulls so large that the farmers could put the skull of the skeleton over their own head while they still had their hat on. The farmer, that is, and you know, this is a mystery. So all these, there's just many newspaper reports about this. It's all pretty well documented. Many bones were sent to Smithsonian, which they're sitting in the basement of, which, you know, like so many boom parts, as they're called, out of place artifacts. But it's a real mystery as to who really built these mounds and some of the techniques they used, mathematics that they use, which also related to both, it was the same mathematics and same units of measure between New World and Old World structures. And so when this story of this Indian grandmother telling our children that they received instructions in the dream time about how to lay these out, because the mathematics of these structures is pretty complex. You know, Gerald Hawkins was kind of the first to break this open with his study of Stonehenge back in the 60s. But this whole archaeoastronomy view of looking at things seems to involve that these people were utilizing highly mathematics using Pythagorean triangles and things like that that certainly weren't normally attributed to people of the Stone Age having the ability to do this. So so they were thinking in terms that mathematical terms that we're really not grasping yet, but you know, we're getting closer and closer. Like you've got your down there in New Zealand, you've got your Martin Dutre, Doutre.
I've had Martin on the show a couple of times. We're sort of good mates, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you know what was really going on with these things, and why have to use such large, difficult stones unless it was much easier for them somehow? Of course, if you're a 10-foot tall, powerfully built. Person of the woods who had maybe that's got something to do with it. I'm not saying that the Sasquatch or the ancient ones were the ones who built them, but I think it's worth exploring. There is hints that might be true to some extent, and supposedly even the ancient ones have told certain people about them, because that seems to be that there's this growing network of information coming from the ancient ones to a variety of just regular folks living out in the rural areas, who have ongoing conversations, not particularly just casual, informal conversations, but now and then do address historical questions, and sometimes the information would point to that these people might have had involvement with these megalithic structures. And perhaps thinking that being like an Aboriginal tribe that thinks logarithmically would be better adapted to understanding the mathematics and what this technology, these structures are trying to achieve and how they achieve it, you know, something we're just grasping with at this point.
What kind of things would we be thinking about that they'd be accomplishing with these stone circles and so on and so forth? I've heard things as big as like just doing sort of spiritual rituals in these type of things, like the Halloween tradition, bobbing for apples.
Well, how do you mean bobbing for apples?
Have you ever tried to bob for apples? You know, you got your hands behind your back and you got apples in a barrel and you try to get an apple out with your teeth, and it's real hard.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Well, way back in the day, allegedly, they used to do that at Stonehenge, except the apples that they were bobbing for, they were trying to sacrifice people, and this happens on Halloween, right? And so in order to save yourself, you had to bob for apples in a cauldron of boiling water. So if you survived, you'd have basically your face burnt up to frack, but at least you'd live. Or you could just go willingly to sacrifice in these circles.
Wow.
And on top of that, they allegedly channel some kind of a power through these megalithic sites, and some people have claimed that they can actually use them for traveling, like from point to point, either on Earth or throughout the universe. I don't know if you've heard of that.
No, but that maybe they're trying to leave. Hints as to how this interdimensional technology works, perhaps.
Well, maybe it just used to work, and all knowledge since has been forgotten.
Right. That certainly seems true, unless it's being held in the archives of the Vatican or something like that. For the most part, that's true. Yeah.
Yeah, like everything else.
Right. Like who killed JR? Yeah. So anyway, yeah. Sorry.
See, I do always wonder about that burning of the Library of Alexandria. Yeah, here's all the knowledge of the entire world's history, ancient scrolls, stuff like that from way back in the day. Let's burn it. No, I don't think they burned it. I think they confiscated all the best stuff for themselves and locked it tidily away, and then burnt the rest of it so that nobody else would have any idea where they came from or who they really are.
Yeah.
You know, if you want to control the future, burn history.
True. Wasn't that 1984? He who controls the past controls the future.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I guess it's an old methodology, isn't it? Now, back on to Sasquatch and hominids. Can I ask, exactly when did this phenomenon start off? I mean, in the modern context, there's been a number of people like yourself and Lloyd Pye who have gone along this area of research and attempted to explain it more clearly to people, because often it's like... What would you say? Elvis is not dead. Like, Elvis is not dead. I saw a Bigfoot, and that's how people demonize you and equate these things. When did that start happening? When did people start saying I saw a Bigfoot, and then everybody started calling them crazy?
Well, you know, I think that's there. You know, that goes back to the control element of society. You know, it's almost like we're living in an alchemical alembic vessel where this hermetic seal. And they talk about hermetically sealing the vessel that your alchemical experiment takes place in. I think that we're hermetically sealed, and we're not supposed to be influenced by anything outside what's in the vessel. And so these things are outside. They're beyond the veil. And it may whack the powers that be may have an agenda for us, whether malevolent or benevolent. But nonetheless,
if they're the powers that be, I can guarantee you it's malevolent. But go ahead.
So it seems. We're not supposed to think outside the box, at least not yet, until either we gain the autonomy that we're supposed to gain by overcoming these forces, and can reason beyond them. But until that day, you know, we're not supposed to get any we're not supposed to cheat by asking for help from the outside or something like that, perhaps. And so I think, you know, it doesn't take much to see that the media will just is a lapdog to something very more powerful. You know, 9/11, it sends that message more than the biggest message to take from 9/11, I think, isn't how corrupt our government is, but how stupid we let the press treat us, or how gullible we are. And it's so easy for the press to do their job in terms of covering things up by ridicule. It's kind of like, you know, the playground antics of ridicule are so strong that these truths, unfortunately, are not being addressed as. But there's so much about Sasquatch coming out, but still it remains in this. View of it's still not taken seriously. That's true. Just like Stonehenge, every time National Geographic does a special on Stonehenge, they spend a whole hour telling you what Stonehenge isn't, without looking at any of the what they call pseudoscience, but is really good science. Like John Michel and Robin Heath and all the work they've done to show that the technology behind Stonehenge and these other megalithic monuments points back to an age where people knew more than we know now about the sizes of the Earth and the relationships between the planetary bodies, and so we're being kept dumb. That's for sure. As to why, maybe we have to undergo the alchemical process without this outside interference, and then when we get to a certain point, we can break the seal and go to the stars or whatever. Something. I'm just waxing metaphors there, but.
Well, I think allegedly not too long ago, I think it might have been 100, 150 years ago or whatnot, the average IQ of people was like 178, and now it's like 110. So something's made us a hell of a lot dumber. And just to clarify for people, going from, say, 110 IQ to 115 IQ or whatever means that instead of being at the back of the class being dumb and not being able to pay attention because you don't know what's going on, you're actually at the front of the class and the A-class student. Like, there's that big a difference. And we've slipped back like a good 10 times that in intelligence since all this public education system began. So we're so dumb now. We're so dumb that we don't even realize how dumb we are. And yet, we get told by people exactly the way things are. And exactly that smart people know exactly what's going on. And they're dumb at the post by comparison to people who live before us. We'll be right back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from New Zealand. And I do want to stress to people that this show is 100% your doing. It's all your fault. So anybody who suggests a guest, we get those guests on. Anybody who donates equipment, we start using that equipment. I just did a big switcheroo last night. A friend of mine, Alan, donated a gargantuan lighting display that's like brighter than the sun baking down on me with mercury-fueled energy saver light bulbs that are like the size of a man's head. And behind me there is I think it might be a 72-inch LCD screen which Barry donated, and that is now being used as the backdrop for the show, with some beautiful images of the New Zealand wilderness, which were donated by my bandmate and good friend, Mikhail. So, you know, ladies and gentlemen, it may look all fancy and what have you, but at the end of the day, this is just all the result of people donating me equipment, because I will use it to great effect. And if you want to give me something that you think I might find useful, just contact me through the website. And at the moment, my car is overheating and has a bit of engine trouble and has a very expensive-sounding rattle, I must say. So any financial support at the moment would be really handy. Probably need about, I think $600. $600 should probably do it to get the car all fixed up, give or take. So if anybody is capable of donating any substantial funds, because I do go out to protests and public meetings fairly regularly, because, well, the mainstream media, whenever they go to these public protests and meetings, never represent what actually happened or really even report on them at all in most cases. Right, now, back to my very special guest, Jeremy Lyons, talking about Sasquatch. Now, do you like what I said before about nowadays knowledge has been destroyed and we've been so dumbed down that we're just so dumb that we don't even know how dumb we are?
Yeah, it's scary. I guess you're familiar with John Gatto and what he talks about through the school system having been designed to do just that purpose, to, like what Bill Gates is reviving, what Carnegie and Rockefeller did back in the 1800s in order to trimline society into a robotic tool. Bill Gates is kind of doing again, as history repeating itself, kind of. Our schools have become like prisons, yeah. But people are waking up and homeschooling and such.
It's interesting. Thing. Somebody told me once about legislation that Adolf Hitler passed and discriminating against groups of people. And apparently the very first group of people that he passed a law to discriminate against wasn't the Jews. It was homeschoolers.
Really? Really?
And the last piece of legislation that he passed to discriminate against people were gun owners.
So, yeah, it makes sense. Yeah. I wanted to show you this book by a guy named David Pollard. Have you heard of him? Can you see this?
No.
Can you see me holding it up?
A little bit, yeah.
And he was a retired police officer from California. He had an interest in Sasquatch, and so he went to the HOPA, H-O-O-P-A reservation in Northern California, where there's a large percentage of sightings by the residents, which are the Hoopa Indians there. And he took with him a celebrated forensic artist, probably the best in the country, who would sketch, Harvey Pratt was his name, he would sketch the descriptions of the people that people would give of the Sasquatch that they encountered. And these more are probably not the Sasquatch, but the ancient ones, because they have a very humanoid look to them. Can you see that at all?
Yeah. You know, what's strange is that as they look in facial appearance, they look kind of similar to Aborigines.
Really? Yeah, here, can you see this one?
Yeah,
very, very humanoid looking, and not so much primate. See, there's another good one here. It looks like a friend of mine. Here it is.
Just looking through the book here, and you know what looks interesting is that they've got these. They've got kind of smiles. They've got beards. They've got defined eyebrows and very human looking faces. Indeed, that's quite astounding.
Yeah, no sagittal wrist crest like a Sasquatch would have so much. And then, you hear some reports about there being different types of Sasquatches even, so it seems to go on and on. Perhaps that's like races here in our human race. You know, there's Caucasians.
And they're all in different parts of the world, aren't they? Like, Asians live right. in Asia, and they've got these Sasquatches there called Yeti in the Himalayas or whatever. And, Hopi Indians and whatever lived in the Americas. And over there we've got Bigfoot, Sasquatch, and so on and so forth down the line in Solomon Islands. They've got different looking people as well as different looking creatures. So, you know, it doesn't seem too much of a stretch of the imagination.
Right, and pretty good documentation of the difference here in America, where the skunk ape in Florida would be smaller, and up in the northeast of the United States, there's in Pennsylvania for many years there's been a three-toed Sasquatch that was very aggressive, evidently. Then there's the Jersey Devil, who seems to be kind of Sasquatchy like, but having his own characteristics as well that has been reported on for the last. Ever since that area has been inhabited. And then, of course, there's all the Indian folklore, the Wendigo, the Manitou, a variety of different names for these entities, and each some of them being different than others. Yeah, it's crazy. It's just a fountain of mystery.
But, I heard that the Wendigo was like something that eats human flesh in order to gain strength or something.
Yeah, though there may be a possibility of some of that being, the boogeyman being, that this unknown creature being exploited by parents who want to keep their children behaving and telling them, don't do this or don't do that or the Wendigo will get you.
If I had kids, I'd just tell them stories about the government to scare the hell out of them.
That would be cruel, because those aren't stories anymore.
Yeah. So go to bed, or the men in black uniforms will get you.
Yeah, but while we're having this conversation, I'd just like to say, Vinny, that I think people at the government are just the nicest people I know. I just want to go on record as saying that the people at the IRS are just they're the tops, and
they're the cream of the crop.
Yeah, and just wanted to make that clear.
Yes, we love you, government. We worship you as a god. If you wear a uniform, you are a representation of the Lord High God, Barack H. O'Berry.
I guess it's the darkest before the dawn. We can always hope, huh?
Isn't that interesting? We elect a black president, and then times become a lot darker.
I'm not going to touch that one with a 10-foot pole.
Saying you can't make this stuff up,
Yeah. Right.
He's like we've got a picture. I think I'll show it to you in the next segment. We've got a picture there called a Game of Drones, and I think that's one of the things that has happening nowadays is a detachment from humanity. Like, in its entirety, people think that if they're wearing a uniform, that they're no longer human, or that they can treat other people as subhuman. And the way that I find that this ties in, strangely enough, with Bigfoot and Sasquatch, is that they're like relatives to us. But if people were to capture them, they'd be tortured, prodded, chained up like they were in Siberia, wouldn't they? As opposed to be treated like distant relatives.
Yeah, if it's a official capture, or you know, by a government agency, I think that would, you know, because they're not a humanitarian project. The some of the Sasquatch groups out there, like BFRO and other research organizations, seem to be adapting more and more a benevolent no capture, no kill, or at least a no kill policy toward the Sasquatch, and even trying to enact legislation to protect them. Just because they're getting pressure from the more humanistic side of their camp. There's always going to be some cowboys out there that could care less, but if their heart and soul is in exploring this subject, you know, for all we can get out of it, then they know that capturing a body and taking it back to a museum isn't going to be worth much compared to understanding this phenomenon on their level, or on everybody's level.
So is there like some kind of a Sasquatch Protection Act in Parliament at the moment?
Yeah, in some states it's already, like I think in Washington there's already a law, and has been for a while, that make it illegal. And so maybe some people don't take it serious, but I think it really does exist. I can't quote, but...
That's quite interesting, because you know how... do you believe leprechauns exist?
You ask me personally?
Yeah.
I think that as a representation of elemental forces that can sometimes personify into entities, I guess so, yeah.
All right. Are there laws against leprechauns? No. there's no law against leprechauns, right? And what I find interesting is like, well, let's say leprechauns don't exist, and that's my premise. For example, like they don't exist in the form that you think they are, you know, like with the little green hats and that, and they, oh, I've got to be put of gold at the end of the rainbow. You know, it doesn't actually exist in that way, and hence there's no laws against it because they don't fucking exist. Conspiracy, on the other hand, there's laws against that, and people think that conspiracies don't exist, even when there's laws that say that it does. If Sasquatch exists, and there's actually laws there to protect them, isn't that a massive red flag to people that maybe people who get demonized saying, oh, I saw Bigfoot and it's just some dude in a suit or whatever, maybe there's something more to look into here?
Yeah, there's it could be a treasure trove of enlightening information that we might gain from them. And but here again, perhaps, you know, the powers that be don't want that released, just like you know, cold fusion or you know, UFO information, anything that's going to just to upset the apple cart, that can be a wild card kind of thing, perhaps.
See, I don't get this, though. How specifically would public knowledge of the existence of Sasquatch, or the ancient ones, as you call them, how would that actually change the structure of, say, the New World Order and the domination? I mean, what would it really cause people to question? I mean, there's an extra species that we didn't know existed until now. I mean, how would that threaten the overall structure?
If the powers that be, like Eisenhower, actually made a deal on the golf course with Zeta Reticuli, if there's any truth to that, or at least any truth to the idea of the powers that be making some sort of arrangement with certain other aliens, the Sasquatch might be able to provide counsel to that relationship and expose it or give us the ins and outs of such a relationship. And therefore, the powers that be may not welcome their advice because they've already cut the deal. And so that might be a motive. One, which would be one good, another good reason to contact, to make contact here on across the veil, and bring them either into our realm, or we somehow get into theirs, or somehow cross that veil and gather that information. Because it, you know, it seems like the powers that be have got us on a course that may be non-sustainable, and if we don't find a means to overcome it. And so perhaps the contact with other entities who don't have a dog in this fight could be beneficial if it could be achieved. And there certainly is a great effort. You find a lot of people out there trying to break this veil, trying to contact us. There are, like I said, there's a couple of different camps, and some of them believe it's just a primate that has this great power to hide itself in your backyard for the last 500 years here in America, as far as either of those, but here they are all over the world. And yet, you know, we can't taxonomically identify them, we can't categorize them in our own, you know, in our biology books. It certainly points the way that this is not just a primate. This has to be, you know, an interdimensional or some sort of, how come we can't get a grip on this game of how we can't categorize them? It just doesn't make sense unless you invoke this other camp view, and that being that they are interdimensional, and it's a whole new ball game, a whole other set of rules. We need to learn it.
I would act under the assumption that the New World Order wouldn't want everybody to think about themselves or other entities as perhaps interdimensional, powerful beings of consciousness. They want to keep us in the 3D with sex, drugs, and rock and roll.
Right. Like Bill, like that joke Bill Hicks talks about, where you never hear on the news about a good LSD trip.
Yeah. Today, a young man on acid realized that all energy is that all matter is merely energy condensed to a slow vibration, and that we are one consciousness experiencing itself subjectively, and we are the imagination of ourselves. Here's Tom with the weather.
Very good, Vinny. Very good. Yeah.
Okay, we're coming to break now, Jeremy. So when we get back, I actually do want to explore this whole consciousness aspect, and more to the point, shamanism as well, I think, might even tie into this a little bit, because there's a lot of potential that human beings have. I mean, we're only using 10% of our brains, and since public education, that's been knocked out to about 1%. We'll be right back after the break at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. We kind of talk about lots of really, really diverse topics on this program. So if you listen 5 days a week, you will grow your knowledge base at a geometric rate, I can assure you, because my knowledge base of just general awareness of things that are happening has grown spectacularly over the years that I've been doing this show. Basically, because I don't know quite so much about the topics of which my guests speak, it means it's a learning experience every single show, which hopefully everybody appreciates and can participate and enjoy as well. All right, so Jeremy, speaking about shamanism, consciousness, and so on and so forth, what are some of the lessons that we could learn from the ancient ones?
Well, this is the key to it, and that's the idea that we need a new Copernican revolution, or a new view of reality that take us away from the old one. And the old one is a reductive materialism, where everything is based on materialism, and consciousness is just this secondary byproduct of these processes that happenstance among material objects. Whereas I think that's the cart before the horse, and the real view, the true view, would be one adopted more and more so by many scientists today, would be that it's a conscious-based universe, and the physical, materialistic view is Maya, or illusion. And it's a good illusion, and it has its place, and it's not to just discount it, everything and go live in a cave, but that the new view of the solar system, the new Copernican revolution, will be one that that puts this cart behind the horse. That the horse is consciousness. That's what drives the universe, and that's the primary thing. And you know, I have a problem with evolution and some of the basic tenets of neo-Darwinism don't quite work, but I think it's often held too fastly by the powers that be, because it supports a reductive materialistic view, and that's a very good means of controlling society. And a conscious-based universe is very empowering, you know, to the individual. And if you can traverse the world through vortexes and interdimensionalism, then you certainly are clued into a conscious-based universe, I think. This kind of relates back to the stone circles as well. When you ask, like, what were they doing? What were they trying to attempt? Well, anthropomorphizing? No, the idea that the universe is a model of the mankind, anthrocosmological principle. The universe is a reflection of the human state.
And I can cite an example here. They've done a snapshot, I think, of a human brain cell. And they also did a representation of what the universe or the structure of the universe looks like. You put them together, and they're like the same thing.
Well, yeah, and so that's a dimension of this principle. And so if they were trying to emulate the sky or the heavens here on Earth, perhaps you know they were trying to create a machine that would interface with between our consciousness, which it seems to be cast out of that garden. We're out of the garden, but in order to get our way back into the garden, to interface back with that machine of the universe, these structures were for that purpose. And I think that as long as we're kind of confined to this view of a materialistic view of life, then we're kind of imprisoned by that, because we're not going to be looking in the right places for the right answers in terms of who we are and what the world is.
Well, see, there's a good lesson right there that you could learn from them, actually knowing how the universe is structured, don't you think?
Yeah, just see, like, even the how the solar system is structured in terms of like the ratios between the planets and such. They're not. We're taught in school that there's nothing significant there, but like Scott Onstott shows, and when he covers Jebb's law, the mathematical principles there are just astounding, and they boggle the mind. We can't really understand them, but we know there's a lot more to it than it just being a unimportant happenstance ratio. It's musical in some ways. It's baffling in others. Pythagorean mathematics, and so on and so on. So, on and on and on.
Now, have you personally actually experienced any trauma or discrimination or attacks as a result of coming out about this this type of phenomena?
Well, I don't get out much, so. not so much. Some people think they don't buy into it, and they think it's a silly subject. Sure, because they haven't looked into it much. But I guess it's getting a little more respectable. With the History Channel is certainly not that they're offering any interdimensional solutions, but I may be touching upon it. I don't know. But I guess there's no such thing as bad press for the most part.
Yeah, I agree. And in general, I think there's so much knowledge out there that we suddenly haven't been exposed to. So if it's news to me, then it's news, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it should be listened to, analyzed, reported if there's some kind of ground and basis to it. Yet this is not the way the world works, is it? If it's real and it's got basis behind it, it doesn't get reported, where if it's right. complete BS, it'll be repeated 1,000 times on the media.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, if there's any discrimination going on, it's almost like the discrimination is the Sasquatch not wanting to be associated so much with the humans and steering clear of them. I think perhaps they consider us somewhat juvenile in our growth of understanding the spiritual and consciousness things that are more important than.
Do you think they single out individuals who perhaps are more akin to accepting them and their way of life and try and seek them out or speak to them, contact them, that kind of thing?
Yeah, I think it's safe to say that they can size somebody up somehow. They can. I don't know if they do it telepathically. But somehow they seem to be tuned into a person's psychic makeup and whether or not they're a redneck who they want to steer clear of. I don't mean to disparage rednecks in general, just nasty rednecks, you know, who would shoot first and ask questions later, as opposed to somebody who would be more open. Perhaps, you know, they could see their aura. You could see somebody's aura and you know, maybe even an enlightened person on a bad day would be somebody they want to steer clear of as well. But then they probably have their off days as well, and you know, they're human, so they may hurt somebody and they may, you know, jump the gun and feel threatened when they might not otherwise have done it on another day and hurt somebody. But for the most part, any time that a Sasquatch does hurt somebody, and there are recorded cases, it seems to be in self-defense. And because, you know, maybe they didn't totally have to, but they seem to retreat more than any other choice. They retreat first.
So have there been documented attacks on people by these creatures?
Yeah, Teddy Roosevelt actually used to talk about one when he came back from California one time on a hunting trip. He related a story that was going around. This was around 1900. Two trappers were out and they set traps out in this wilderness of California. But soon they felt like they were being watched, and they felt heavy, just a heaviness in the air. They didn't know quite what to do with. And over the next couple of days, things would occur that they come back and their camp had been ramshacked or you know, destroyed. They were awakened at night by red glowing eyes, and the vibes were so bad they decided to pack up. And one of them was sent to go get the traps, and the other one was sent to pack, or the other one stayed to pack up. And when the guy getting the traps got back, the other one had been killed, bitten in the neck broken and bitten into. And it's a famous story. It's quoted in just about every Sasquatch book from the past. And, you know, maybe the Sasquatch didn't much appreciate a couple of guys coming in and taking all his whatever he thought of them taking the, you know, setting traps maybe he had an opinion about that. Maybe he just had an opinion about having two white guys, you know, disrupting his territory. But evidently he did kill them. There's stories of Thomas Bay up in Alaska, around 1900 as well, where they were attacked by ape men, these gold miners, prospectors. Also in Ape Canyon, Washington, prospectors around 1920, maybe, I'm not sure the exact date, had a roundabout with a gang of Sasquatch, and they attacked the cabin. Also, that encounter, they recorded there being telepathic communication with one of the miners. So it's kind of strange. And few other cases, but for the most part, of all the encounters of Sasquatch, for the most part, they just turn and walk away, no matter what happens. As long as I'm telling tales, little anecdotes, I'd like to tell one. There's a guy, he was a founding citizen of Seattle. He wrote a book in the late 1800s about Mount Rainier and his explorations on Mount Rainier. And in there, there's a chapter called The Old Man of the Crater. And he talks about how when him and his and about four other fellows were camped out there's a cauldron there on Mount Rainier, a volcanic cauldron. They were camped out, and he had this desire in the middle of the night to go exploring into the cauldron. And I guess he had a flashlight. I don't know what they had back then, but he was able to go into one of the lava tunnels, one of the lava tubes, and he shortly encountered a large, hairy man, as he described him, coming up from below. And this large, hairy man did a rather odd thing. He rubbed his feet on the ground and generated sparks coming off of himself. And then he saw this guy who wrote the book was named Colonel John Ingram. He saw Colonel John Ingram there standing there in the lava tube, and they had a telepathic conversation. And John Ingram described it as being able to speak with the mind. And the Sasquatch related a few things of this and that nature, one of them being that him and his race were kind of stuck here on this planet and couldn't leave because of what was kind of described as a cometary impact at some time. And also the large hairy man tried to encourage him, Colonel Ingram, to follow him back down into the depths of the lava tunnel. And Colonel Ingram, Captain, I forget if it's Captain or Major, I forgot his rank, but John Ingram, resisted almost like a spell coming over him, resisted a spell and declined, following him back down, and went back to the camp. And he wrote this in his book. And this guy was, you know, the book's a famous book. You can get it in the library in Seattle. And John Ingram was a upstanding citizen and wrote other books. And yet here he is talking before anybody knew anything about Sasquatch in that area, for the most part, I mean, as a general public information. Here he is writing about this encounter with this telepathic encounter with a Sasquatch in the lava tubes of Mount Rainier. Pretty bizarre.
Yeah. And in terms of more recent encounters, are there documented cases? Because now with technology, with the iPhones and the camera phones and handy cams and so on and so forth, one would assume that if encounters kept on happening, that documented evidence of a video or pictorial nature would be coming out.
I know it, and I know it's like they can find cops beating up people every which way you turn because everybody's got a video cam. But so why isn't this happening? Why is it still that the best film we've got is from 1968, the Roger Patterson film? Unless you just have to almost assume that there's some sort of force that keeps this seal, this hermetic seal between this veil between us. And like there was a video that came out of Salt Lake or Utah where these two young couples were hiking and they saw what they thought was a bear up on a hill above them. So they trained their camera on it. And after a few seconds, it stood up and walked away and it was apparently a Sasquatch, and they didn't realize it until it stood up. And it kind of freaked them out, of course. But we get shots like that, you know, but nothing that we can really take to the bank where you can just, you know, lay it down in front of anybody and say, you know, here, go ahead and test this. Anything you want to subject it to, by gosh, it's a Sasquatch, and there's no two ways around it, and they're out there. But we just don't.
Well, you know what? I would wonder if they've got the ability to figure out whether or not somebody's got a recording device on them and are so cryptic they don't want to be captured on camera, and they've figured it out. And it's just like, you know what? I reckon psychically that this dude's got an iPhone on him. When are we getting the frack out of here? We'll be right back after the break at thevinnyeastwoodshow.com. ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's our final segment here with Jeremy Lyons. Now, Jeremy, you know, whenever you're on radio or in any kind of public speaking forum, there's normally things that you just sort of don't, that you sort of try not to mention because it's a little bit far out and you think people might think, you know, this guy might be a little, I mean, what he said so far is a little bit out there, but man, this just takes the cake. And I like to encourage people to give us those juicy nuggets of self-censored information. So if there's anything of that nature that you don't normally talk about on air or when you're discussing Sasquatch, are there any aspects like that you'd like to discuss, or have you just kind of opened the book?
Oh, gee, I feel like I'm on a psychiatrist's couch. No, for the most part, there's nothing about them that is you mean embarrassing like or just so far out. Just so, you know, it depends on somebody's threshold as to whether or not it's too far out or not, I guess.
Well, let's say something that's a little bit far out even for you, something that you have trouble processing.
Yeah, well, okay. Kiwani, you know, will tell me things, and there's things in his book that you have to wonder how much, either his own experience or experience of other people, how much there might be a filtering going on of some sort where they're thinking they're receiving information telepathically, that the information is getting filtered and turned into a more personal reflection of their own self. You know, supposedly the Sasquatch seem to be, the ancient ones will tell people things about what's going on in their life. So as if they, because they're psychically endowed and have this extrasensory perception and have information about their lives that they just wouldn't think a forest creature would have. And yet they even give advice, you know, like their personal love affairs or things like that. And when Kiwani tells me these things, I truly believe he's telling the truth and that these people are telling the truth. But is there some filtering going on? I have to question just as from a scientific perspective, you know, because it is very far out. Things like, you know, an automobile might have some damage to it, but the Sasquatch were aware of it and they actually interceded psychically to help the automobile not have an accident or something like that. It seems very outrageous, but in a world of when you're living in a conscious-based universe, you know that perhaps that is the reality, and you don't have to have a three-dimensional materialistic rendition of reality in order to, you know, to do these things, and they actually have this ability because that's the world they live in. So, but it's far out, but only because it's hard for us to accept, because we live in it. We still have remnants of living in, or some people live totally in a materialistic world and a cause effect where everything's linear versus non-linear, and synchronicity. You know, what Jung, the kind of world Carl Jung was describing, where, you know, it's shamanic as well.
So not entirely unsimilar. Like, it's kind of like not understanding the layout of somebody's house, for example. You know, like you walk into a house. Let's say you're somebody and you walk into a house and there's no TV, and you're like, well, where are you supposed to put your furniture? You know, they just don't know. They just don't understand because they've never seen a house without a television set. Is it something like that? Like we just don't kind of understand the makeup or the positioning or the motivations behind them, and through our inability to understand, because we've got our own reality that we're still trying to filter through and come to terms with ourselves. These things appear extremely confusing, and more to the point, when things are really confusing, people often get really angry.
Yeah, rejecting it. What kind of social structure they have is an enigma, and supposedly it seems that a likely candidate would would be a tribal model. They have councils among the tribes, and all very informal. You know, we were talking about the violence, and supposedly one of the stories related to somebody about what was going on among one of the tribes was that they had a member, a Sasquatch member, or here again it may have been an ancient one, I'm not sure, can't remember, was very malevolent character, was killing regular human, our people, was just had a disposition to kill regular people, our human people, our people. And the other Sasquatch decided that this had to stop, and they actually killed him, this rogue ancient one. And so they have their own social ups and downs as well, it would seem, and their own structure to meet those problems.
You know? Well, one would say that they're probably not the be-all and end-all enlightened beings then, would they?
No, they have their ups days and down days and such. Yeah. Yeah, but I think that they are different from us. I don't really have much evidence to go with this theory that I have, other than it just, to me, it makes sense from what I've put together. The idea that they think logarithmically, we think arithmetically, and therefore they may be more practiced at understanding the makeup of the universe, because the universe is logarithmic. And for whatever reason, we don't have hair, can't survive out in the wild, and are forced to use our technology to survive, starting with fire and working our way up to automobiles and agriculture and so on. For whatever reason, we like that, until we can cross the threshold and understand the universe in our own way. Perhaps they can give a clue as to what we're missing.
So in your opinion, and we're coming almost to the end of the show, what is it, do you think, that humanity's missing that the ancient ones might be able to give us?
Well, that view of looking at the world mathematically in the terms of logarithms, you know, and a conscious base, you know, we're stuck in this thinking of the world as being a materialistic, reductive materialistic. That's our official party line. That's the line academia takes. That's why we have a Darwinian theory of the origin of life being this astronomically fortunate, fortuitous combination of amino acids that brings life. But when you look at the odds against that, it's just so far out that so many scientists have jumped ship. Even, you know, the physicist John Wheeler long ago said it's a conscious-based universe. Francis Crick doesn't believe in evolution. He believes in panspermia because he couldn't buy into the odds. Of course, that's panspermia is just kind of like transferring it to another arena. But he had to reject the idea of it being generated by chance, because amino acids are so many different combinations that, you know, the number theory just doesn't work out. And so that paradigm needs to be dropped, because it's not a life didn't come from happenstance like that so much. Maybe it came from happenstance, but it didn't come from materialistic happenstance. It's, a conscious-based solution would be, you know, we're looking on the wrong side of the street for our keys, you know. Like you lose your car keys and you look for them under the streetlight, but when you've lost them on the other side of the street and where it's dark, but you're looking on underneath the streetlight because the light's better. Well, that's kind of like what we're doing. We can see better with a materialistic, we're comfortable with a materialistic view, and we want to look in that materialistic view, but the keys are actually on the darker side of the conscious-based universe, of which we don't know hardly anything about. We don't have even got a good definition of consciousness, other than like the one for pornography, where we don't know what it is, but we know it when we see it, kind of thing. But there's so many good examples of occurrences that show that the if you can give one good example of consciousness surviving the brain, then you kind of like throw out the whole materialistic view. And there's so many good examples of the body surviving the brain. It's, you know, like Rupert Sheldrake works on proving this so much that once you do accept the idea that consciousness can survive outside the body, then you kick out the supports of a materialistic view, and you have to by default go to a consciousness-based universe view, and from there the sky is the limit in terms of what's possible. And the Sasquatch kind of show what's possible. The ancient ones show what's possible. Interdimensional travel form, that would be interesting. So.
It would be nice not to be stuck in traffic ever again, I've got to go to my mate's place and it's rush hour and it'll take me 3 hours to get there. You know what? I think I might just astral travel this one. Hey, bro, how's it going? Oh, it's all good, man.
Yeah. Did you see today on the BBC they had a thing about a bicycle, where your bicycle can fly?
I didn't.
They showed it off at the BBC studios today. Somebody's invented a bicycle. It's got a powered fan on it. It can go up to 4,000 feet for 30 minutes. So you can bypass traffic if you can get a FAA certification or whatever. But so, yeah, but that's the way we approach. Rather than astrally, we approach things mechanically. But that's our lot. So to the stars we go.
Well, something tells me that we're incredibly limited when we look at things in that way, whereas consciousness in the universe is infinite.
Yeah.
And vastly superior in terms of that way. Jeremy Lyons, thank you very much for your time today, and I hope you have a fabulous life. Thank you very much.
Jenny, I enjoyed it immensely.
See you again sometime.
Take care. Bye.